reduction. I had the idea of doing this because it seemed to me, being a historian as well as somebody who cared passionately about council, that there have been, that migration is nothing new, that actually Oxford is full of people who've come now, today, from other places, some of them within the British Isles, but an awful lot not within the British Isles. That if you start thinking about what makes a home, what makes a sense of belonging, it's quite an interesting concept, and you take yourself back all the way to the Vikings and people like that and what was going on in Oxford, if you like, then, where it looked as if people wandered in from other places and became part of the community, and stayed here and died here and had their children here. You can tell from looking at what's in their bones where they were born, how they come. So this whole sense of them and us, we belong, you don't, it's a false thing in many ways. Most of us, I'm sure, in this room would think it was a false thing, but actually it's very fluid. People come in, they settle, they get on with each other. As Morris was talking to me a couple of days ago, some of them even start saying, no, we don't want him. We are now, we were the them, but we're now the us, and we don't like them. There's a fluidity about it, which is part of a living place, a living population. I mean, it's just what happens. So it's like language will change over time, depending on who's there and what's going on. So will people. And I asked Morris East, who is a historian of local things, but with a national, as all local historians do, you have a national kind of view as well. I've asked Danny Doring, who has his geographer's kind of wonderful perspective over the whole thing, and I've asked Jabu, with partly from her lived experience, but also from her fantastic fighting self for, I mean, for instance, Mothers for Justice that you've set up. I'm sure you'll be able to say a bit more about that. To start us off on a journey, the three of them, one after another, will talk about what they're going to talk about. And then I want to open it up to all of you to contribute, to say, well, what is it that makes Oxford a place that has welcomed me, that has meant I want to come here and belong? And what were the awful barriers that stopped me, you know, that nearly made me not come, that I had to overcome in order to live here? And I think those questions and the answers to those questions are ones which the City of Sanctuary needs to hear, the University of Sanctuary needs to hear, the other University of Sanctuary needs to hear, and the County of Sanctuary needs to hear, because if they're really places that say they offer sanctuary, then there should be no question mark at the end of Welcome to Oxford. So I shall start. We're doing Danny first.
Yes, yeah, I'll go first.
Great, thank you. I'll sit down.
I'm the warmer pack. So
the bottom one.
Here? Depends on what I'm doing.
Morris, do you want to come and sit here for the time being? Just so that people can see over our heads.
There we go. I often used to start talks in Oxford, so I'll do it now, by saying, how many people were actually born in the city? So let's have a go. So I was. Oh, you're doing well. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. That's the second highest I've ever done. For adults. Obviously, if you do school children, they're more likely to be. So it's a minority. The highest was somebody running an alternative PPE course for adults with mental health problems. And of course, the lowest is always in the university. So this is a city of migrants. But Moise is going to talk more about that. I'm going to be quick. I was going to show you a world map, but I'll just tell you. Globally, Europe has remarkably low numbers of migrants, refugees, incomers. I'm not going to make a particular distinction between these groups, but Europe is low globally. Most people who move in the world don't move very far, move to the next door country, which you probably know, so I didn't need to show you that. I'm also not going to show you a European map about people who move around Europe, just to tell you that most of the UK has some of the lowest proportions of people born abroad or from elsewhere in Europe. We are the equivalent of Eastern Europe for how few people we actually have. So we're not a high migration country, we're not a high migration continent. But also I'd argue that there aren't actually that many refugees in Oxford. Most refugees end up in other parts of the country because it's incredibly expensive to be here. Sadly, because of Campsfield, which may have been the largest European detention centre at one point. Yeah, that is the reason why we would show up on the map. North-South divide. I draw maps. So I'm just going to show you some things you might not know, literally in about 6 minutes. I did these with Beth and Thomas. This country's geography is very, very simple, really. There is London, and out of London, and out of London. And you think you're in Oxford, but really you're just in a part of London. And then there is the north. And you can always argue about where the line is. Now, at some point, somebody decided that we were going to have 84 European constituencies. As far as I was aware, they were never used, but I made a map of them. So there they are. And that's a strange shaped picture of Britain. You have to kind of memorise it very quickly. The height is done by social geography. So the lower, the more likely a child is to go to university. So if you look, there's a T at the bottom, going from 11 to 3 to 9. That's where you're most likely, the most affluent part of the UK. And you can see some of the Highlands as you move out. 78 is the poor part of Glasgow at the time. There's a human geography to the country. 11, for those who have very good eyesight at the front, is what was going to be Buckinghamshire and Oxfordshire East, slightly posher area, and 13, Hampshire North and Oxford. Now the reason for showing you that is that, and this is from 20 years ago, the highest numbers of unusual groups in terms of compared to national average for both of those was people from the European Union. That's the group we have more of than others. Yeah. But what fascinated me when I drew this is way back to 2001 census, is that ring of orangey areas with OI, which stands for other immigrants, which is people in the 2001 census who hadn't been in the UK a year earlier and were not white. And you can just see the pushing out, and you all know about schemes and resettlement and going to Sight Hill in Glasgow, but this created a particular geography in Britain about where people were welcome or where they were pushed to. So I've lived in Sheffield, I've lived in Leeds, far more people from other countries without money in those places. Here, lots of people from other countries with lots of money. An incredible kind of switch around. I'll let Moise talk about the city, but it's a switch around. So we shouldn't fool ourselves that there are that many people here from elsewhere who are not very rich. Mm-hmm. It's not that we are full of people in any way in Oxford, let alone Britain. Just some graphs, because I never understood why we don't have these graphs. In the USA, these things are celebrated, not in the UK. Census data from 1841, proportion of people born in the British Isles, those not born in the British Isles. Very, very high numbers born in the British Isles. This is the kind of graph you get in the USA all the time, celebrating the diversity of the USA, despite issues in the USA. Look at the increase, look at the huge number of places that people come from. And it's slightly complicated. Empire returns home, but other groups. What I'm not showing, of course, is that this set of countries sent more people abroad than proportionally than ever came in. Mostly pushed out from Scotland, from the clearances, pushed out from Ireland, the poor pushed out from England, around the world, colonising. Quickly going forward, this is just warm up, same graph but as a percentage, and actually proportion all aboard went down, 1860s to 1921. It changes. Things have got to be going relatively well for people to come. I just picked out one graph. Percentage of people with British nationality by country of birth 2014, 2 years before the referendum. You didn't need British nationality if you were from Lithuania, Latvia, Poland, Romania and Portugal at that point. Why would you bother? You had a right to be here. But the proportion from Singapore, Zambia, Uganda, Kenya and Tanzania was 80-90% of people. These are all things we count. Almost at the end. Why am I bothered about this? For some people will now in the audience, I grew up in a mixed family in Oxford in the 1970s. My mum literally used a bowl and scissors. That's my next brother down. And two of my brothers, not white, in Oxford in the 1970s and 80s. And I'll let you, my youngest brother, who thankfully isn't here, but has given me permission to show you his six-pack. is aunt. Both aunt and Ben's fathers came over from the Caribbean in the 1970s, and the reason why they couldn't work with their fathers is because of racism in the very early 1970s. Some things have got better. The racism that we had in the 1970s, we do not have that now. It was, if for those who are old enough to remember, it was very vicious. I'll put it crudely, you joined Thames Valley Police, or whatever it was called back then, not for the salary, because it was very low. You joined the police because you had a license to beat up black people. That was the 70s in Oxford. Things do change. And I think I'm almost at my last slide. There are loads of statistics you can look up and loads of things, but the key thing is not to think that we're particularly high. It's when you look at other parts of the country and poorer parts. And in particular for Oxford, as we have welcomed in, attracted, advertised for, desperately needed, more rich people from overseas, who are often from a very diverse set of backgrounds. Something like 30-35% of our postgraduates at the university are not white, but 90% of them are richer than I am, or their families are. Which is a really interesting set of people. Census map, that 92.9% is down in part of Blackford Leigh, so people who've lived at the same address for a year. At parts of Oxford where things move less, and then you can see the circle in the middle, the light yellow, where at the lowest only 6.4% of people were there a year ago. Right? Really weird, high turnover, hotel, bubbling city. Changes over the last 10 years, proportion born in England, in Oxford dropping from 68% to 62%. So increasingly diverse, but my crude way of putting it is it's my favourite book about Oxford is Bryce Head Revisited. The description and also the politics of the time. Sebastian turned up with his servant. That's what your scouts were. The equivalent, now we're back in a sense, certainly in terms of the social group who turned up, but it's postgraduates who are in the same position internationally as Sebastian was nationally. But you don't have to turn up with your servant now, because there are people who will come and deliver you a pizza on a bike. Yeah. Right? We're still a servant culture. And extend it to, and there are school teachers who cannot afford to have children, because they're living six to a student house, and one definition of what it is to be a servant is not being able to have children. So in some ways Oxford hasn't changed, in other ways it has changed. And that's my very last slide, and a gratuitous advert, because you've got to ask, what are people walking into? you know, if you knew, rather than the English language, reconnecting with family and so on, if you actually knew what the opportunities were, you'd try and jump to Canada, to be honest, about it. So that's a kind of warm-up before we hand over to Morris.
And that's your book?
That is a book coming out, which is talking about seven children, and that is the income distribution of children in the country. We have the greatest inequality in Europe now. We're just about beating Bulgaria. So you arrive here, which normally means unless you've got huge amounts of money, you're going to slot right down into the bottom, and you're going to be poor for your whole life, but your children might have a chance. You are walking into, in many ways, the worst part of Europe to do this. The poorest fifth of families in the UK are poorer than most of the poorest fifth in most of Eastern Europe. It's an exceptional situation that we are currently in as a country. You could say, in some ways, it's reminiscent of when we had migration and refugee streams here from 1905 onwards, famously from Eastern Europe. You're walking into a very poor country for most people, even though we're the richest country in the world, but not for most people. Yeah. We have some of the lowest life expectancies in Manchester and Liverpool in the world, despite being the richest country in the world. And you're walking into the poorest parts of the country back then. Very different middle of the century. Middle of the century, Enoch Powell went out and asked people, you know, to come. Please come and work the night shift in the mills. Please come and work in the NHS. Enoch did that before he did the Trivial Blood speech. Mm-hmm. What happened to you depended quite a lot on chance. If you were unlucky in some way, you end up in a northern mill town. If you're lucky, you end up in Brixton in the 1970s or 80s. Just chance over where you end up, what happens to house prices, if collectively you all manage to get together and buy some houses. So we have a plethora of stories about what happened in this country. We're currently at a high point of fear again. Fear is being used by both of the main two political parties and Little Offshoot Reform back again. I told you things got better, and in terms of fiscal finance, from my point of view, they did from the 70s. And of course, the slogan of the 1970s of the National Front was "Send them back." And we've had this, which is just something to be ashamed of. That's long enough for a warm-up.
Thank you very much, Danny. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Liz. I've got to change over the memory stick.
He says, a warm-up. We're now going to go on to some history as opposed to some graphs which represent people. And we're looking forward to Morris, who will tell us about some of the communities that have come to Oxford over the years. But it's quite an interesting thought, who would actually want to come to Britain at the moment if they were in their right minds. However, you done?
I'm done.
Great. Over to you, Morris.
Thank you very much, Liz. Thanks, Danny. I like I'm the warm-up. Is this on, by the way? Am I working?
Working. Fantastic.
Right, good evening, everyone. I'm going to talk about how Oxford in the 20th century came into being the city that we have now. And that is a story about a lot of internal immigration, internal migration, and about people who came to Oxford and made this town what it is today, really, and certainly the town that I remember growing up in the 1970s and 80s. And I don't look old enough to be grown up in those decades. The more I say that joke, the less laughs I get. It's amazing. So, Michael talks. So, I'll start off with. Took a while, didn't it, Danny? It takes a while. It does work.
I hope I didn't turn it off.
Can you tell us where those children are?
Yes, that's my next thing.
All right, let's just see if it's working. There you go. Now we're rocking.
Yes, that was my next thing. Now, sorry for that delay. That's a delayed punchline. Worst thing for a stand-up comedian. Does anyone know where that picture was taken?
Cowley Centre.
Cowley Centre, fantastic. Oh, you were straight in there. I was going to say, not if you were born in Oxford. Yeah, that's taken at Cowley Centre. And that's taken in the 1970s, before they put the roof on Cowley Centre. I remember that fountain. I remember going to that fountain. You all remember that fountain because it didn't work. That's where you always sit on that fountain because the thing never worked. Like a poor man's Barbara Hepworth. But the thing about Cowley Centre, I always think, and this is again a great picture of Cowley Centre in its heyday, not long after it was constructed and before they put the roof on in the 80s and it became Templar Square. This is Cowley Centre, and it is a physical embodiment of a future Oxford, an Oxford that was required. You know, you don't get many examples in Oxford of like 1950s post-war optimistic architecture for the public. And this building was constructed specifically for the needs of car workers. It was designed because Oxford had experienced a very late industrial revolution, a very late industrial boom, and car work. And what was required was an alternative centre where car workers could congregate and shop, something that rivalled the old medieval city. And it's hard to imagine now that there was ever this suggestion that there would be an alternative viable centre to the one we have now. So Cowley Centre is really the embodiment of that in bricks and mortar. And it was because of this, because of the car factory. That's a car factory in its heyday, probably taken in the 1960s. As you can see, it was a huge building. I mean, you could have lived in Oxford now for 30 years. The North Works and South Works, which are just up here, my thing's working, but North Works and South Works, they were demolished in the early 1990s. But certainly the Oxford that I grew up in, it was a car factory. It was a car factory town, and it was a town that was, you know, that was dominated by the car factory. It was where my father worked. It was where my uncles worked. Where my grandfather worked. And it had a workforce about 20,000 people, and it was really a rival to the old university, because up until that point, the university had really come to dominated Oxford. The university had been very resistant to the Industrial Revolution. There had been many attempts during the 19th century to stop the industrialisation of Oxford. Oxford was seen as a provincial, a semi-rural place, a place where people, rich people, posh people, came to be educated, a bucolic place, a place that really was going to avoid any sense of industrialisation. And I think the best way to think about the university at this stage, at the start of the 20th century, is somewhere that is deeply ingrained with old power, historical power. The roots of power that go back to somewhere like the Square Mile in the City of London. That's, I think, that is the best comparison you can have. And I always think that Oxford is not a town with a university, it is a university town. But the onset of the car factory kind of changed everything. And if you think that this is Cowley at the turn of the century, this is what Cowley used to look like. Cowley was one of a number of villages that ringed Oxford. You would have Iffley, Cowley, Headington, Barton, Marston. These were rural, semi-rural communities that weren't even within the city boundary at the start of the 20th century. The population of Oxford in 1901 was about 50,000. The population in 1951 was about 100,000. And that's the same view now. Massive changes. And it is down to the explosion that happened in the 1920s and 30s with the start of the car factory. And that was started by William Morris, the ultimate local boy done good. He was born in Cowley. He grew up in Cowley, not far from where I took this photograph. And the explosion in the factory necessitated the need for extra labour. Now, in the initial decades, this was taken up by the local workforce. But there was a huge change in 1926 with the advent of the Press Steel Factory. That was a coordination with the Budd Corporation of Philadelphia, an American company. And they set up the Press Steel Factory. And that was when Oxford really exhausted all of its local labour. And it needed extra labour to come in from outside. Now, at that period of time in the 20s and 30s, the rest of the UK was experiencing
economic depression, like the Wall Street. We had the Wall Street crash in the late 1920s, and a lot of the traditional industries that the country was built on, shipbuilding, steel and iron production, and particularly coal mining, were going into steep decline. So you have people from depressed areas looking around for work and opportunities. And one of the most famous, probably the most famous migrant community that came into Oxford was from the South Wales coal valleys. This is a place called Pontycumber. I went there and I took this picture. This valley in particular saw a disproportionate number of people from South Wales move to Oxford and to start up a new life here. Now, one of the new arrivals who came here was this man put the red arrow on. This is a guy called Arthur Axel. Now, he wrote a very good memoir about how he arrived in Oxford and how he found a job at the car factory and his life and how he set up a new life here. So Arthur Axel arrived on a hunger march. The hunger marches had been set up in the 1920s in response to the severe depression that was going on all over the country, but in particular in South Wales. And men would march en masse to London to protest about the conditions they were in. These marches were organised by the Communist Party of Great Britain. And Arthur Axel, he found himself 18 years of age, marching to London. And he stopped in Oxford, and he was given a very warm reception in Cornmarket Street, and he had a look around, and he was beguiled by what he saw, and he decided to stay. What's interesting about Arthur Axel is that, he came from a South Wales mining community, but he'd ended up there because his parents were actually originally from Gloucester. He was only a first generation Welshman. They had moved to the valleys because they had seen opportunities for work in the coal mining boom. So that's how he had ended up there, because his parents had moved for work. I think his father worked for the railways. So that's how they had ended up in South Wales. And yet within a generation, he was looking for work. He was walking along the A40 and finds himself in Oxford. So he stays, he gets a job in the milk round initially. And he does say in the memoir, Oxford actually gave a lot of contributions to mining communities in South Wales. But there's a difference between being generous to miners from afar, but when they actually come to stay, his welcome was not particularly warm. He does write about people in lodging houses saying, no Welsh here. So, but he stays and he settles, he gets a job, and eventually he gets a job at the car factory, he gets a job at Radiators in Summertown, and he meets a local girl, who's Mabel on the county road, and they get married, and they end up in a flat in Headington, and they have a child. And he sends a letter home to South Wales to say there's work here, and his brother Ivor turns up. And suddenly, this is how it happened, really, for not just the Welsh communities, but communities in Liverpool, in Scotland, and on Tyneside. People would come to Oxford, find out there was work, and they would send news back, or they'd visit back, and they'd send letters, and more people would arrive, and they'd find a network of Welshmen, or Geordies, or Scousers, who were willing to help them. Maybe there was a shared house, or those sorts of things. So this is what you find. But one of the problems that you have, and there's a picture of some of the hunger marches coming in. You see Rhonda Unites here. But you may not be able to believe this, because there was a huge influx of people into Oxford. There was a housing crisis. Now, obviously, all the housing problems in Oxford have been sorted by now. But this huge influx of labour caused a serious problem, because this was a huge boom. This was unprecedented in the history of Oxford. I like to think of it as the comparison I use in other talks. It was Detroit on Thames. And I think that's a very real thing. There was a real comparison. There was a huge boom. We're talking about the boom started really after the First World War. William Morris didn't build his first car until 1913. He didn't properly build his factories until after the First World War. So suddenly you have this huge boom in the 20s and 30s where Oxford has a massive industry that it's got no experience of having before, and a huge influx of people. Where are these people going to live? Where are they going to stay? Now, William Morris, the owner of Morris Motors, he's not going to build Port Sunlight, he's not going to build Bourneville Village. He leaves this to the council. The council at this time is a Conservative council. Oxford is both a small C and a large C Conservative place. As we walked into this institution tonight, you could feel the Conservatism everywhere. And we're in the Margaret Thatcher suite. Growing up in 80s Oxford, it's hard to think that Oxford's ever been anything other than a bit of a Labour stronghold. But this was not the case. And some of the story that I'm going to tell tonight is about how that change came about and how we get the politics that we have right now. But so the building of new houses was left to property developers, and one of the property developers built Florence Park Estate. That was probably the most famous estate that Roy had constructed. Here it was houses to rent. Here we go, Mr. Moss. There's a whole story about him, but here we go, parlour type houses, housing specialists, some of the best houses in the world. You've heard all this before. So Arthur Axel looks around and he thinks, yeah, I fancy a bit of Florence Park. That sounds good. That's a place where I can raise a family. So he moves in the early 1930s to this house in Campbell Road, still there. I think it's number 31. But what he finds quite, and actually the Florence Park becomes known generally as Little Rhondda. That's how many Welsh people move in. Also Geordies as well. There's an annual, I think, Christmas match between the Geordies and the Welsh. So a very diverse community, but it's very poorly built. You won't believe it, but these developers didn't care about the houses they were building. Like I say, you know, some things don't change particularly. But what happened was that people like Arthur Axel and some of the other people, they'd come in from outside, they'd come from more established industries, from more militant communities, and they were not going to stand for renting shoddy houses. So they ended up with a rent strike, and they became very organised very quickly. I do like the legend on here, which I think says, built 1934 and still going wrong. About how badly and shoddily this was built. But the most important thing is that there was these new arrivals brought a new militancy and a new level of organisation, because they weren't going to take it. And to be honest, when you read people at the time who had come from other parts of the country, they couldn't believe how passive the local Oxonians were, because they'd been used to the biggest employer being the university. Arthur Axel and others use the expression, the local people in use to the crumbs from the table. Suddenly you had a good blue-collar jobs at the factory, an influx of people with ideas about unionisation and union power, and the social, cultural and political life of Oxford started to change quite radically. In 1934, about this time, you also have a huge strike at Pressteel. Again, agitation from new arrivals about poor working conditions, bad rates of pay, safety issues, and union recognition. Women get involved in this, a great picture, your fight is our fight, we're behind you. And then because of this, you get other arrivals. Abraham Lazarus, he arrives from London. He's a Communist Party organiser. He arrives in the city. He becomes a very big noise in local politics. There's great stories about him giving speeches on a Sunday in St Giles and saying he was such a passionate, charismatic speaker. Thousands of people would turn up, and the dons in their offices would quake in fear listening to his rhetoric, which I always like the idea of. At the same time, you've got the Cutslow Wars. Again, another old conversation we can have about that. Abe Lazarus leads a demonstration there. Thousands of people turn up in protest about this. I mean, it looked like we could be East Berlin there. But again, that's another story. But to go back to the Welsh influence in the city cements itself. Oxford has a male voice choir, as it says there. You can't stop them singing. I guess it depends if you like male voice choirs or not. But you can see that's still going strong. That's from last year. That's from the valleys to the shires. Again, the Oxford male voice choir, this idea that you've got people moving from the valleys of Wales to Oxfordshire, bringing their culture, bringing their politics, bringing their militancy. So the factor that I remember, this is in the post, after the Second World War, is this one. That this is before the flyover was built. As I always orientate myself, the two chimneys have gone. The one chimney, I think, is where the Premier Inn is now, and opposite the chimneys is where Tesco's is now. But everything, the North Works and South Works, sadly demolished with undue haste by BMW back in the early 90s. But one of the consequences of this huge factory was that in the post-war era, Oxford was a place where you had tens of thousands of good blue-collar jobs. And this is the place my dad always used to say. He said, you'll be on the line, Morris, and you'll be working next to plumbers, plasterers and electricians, because this is where the money was in Oxford. So getting a job there was a plum job. But that had a consequence for other parts of Oxford economy. So, for example, in the 1950s, the price of the success of this factory was that the Oxford Bus Company couldn't get enough people to run the buses. So in 1955, there were severe problems with the operation of buses in Oxford. They had to find other sources of labour. So in the same year, the Oxford Bus Company employed 12 West Indian ex-servicemen from the Brixton Labour Exchange. to work on the buses. There's a glossy, a bus that's Gloucester Green, if you can believe that. And other parts of the Oxford economy were suffering as well. The postal service, the railways, the hospitals. Because again, this Oxford became a place attractive to migrants because it was needed to run this city that was being supercharged by the economy of the car factory. And then from the 50s onwards, you have an influx of West Indian, Pakistani, Bangladeshi, and many other communities into the city. And many of those communities settled in East Oxford, where at that time, that was the cheapest part of the town you could live. And it would be the same situation for the Welsh. You would have, people would send letters home, they would people from other parts of the country would hear that people that they knew, friends and relatives, were settling in Oxford. They could come here, they could get a start, they could maybe share a house, they could pool their money together and buy a house. Anything was possible for them. But interestingly enough, what you did have then on the line, this is taken in the late 1960s at the car factory, was you had a sense that some of the more established communities in Oxford, it may well have been the people who arrived from Wales, a lot of the white working class in Oxford, did not like the idea of having new migrants working alongside them on the line. Yeah. And in 1964, there was cases of white workers refusing to work alongside a West Indian man who had been employed at the factory to work on the line. And it took the intervention then of a convener, a man called Bobby Fryer, to tell the workers on the line that if they didn't like it, if they weren't prepared to work next to whichever man that they wanted to, then they could leave the factory. It wasn't the question of other people leaving. If you didn't want to work next to that man, then you leave the factory. And again, I remember my dad telling me stories about men who left the factory because they weren't prepared to do that. But what's interesting about Bobby Fryer is that, that sounds a very English name, but Bobby Fryer was a man who'd escaped Hungary and escaped the Nazis in 1938 as a 12-year-old. He'd come to England, he'd joined the army, and then in the 50s he'd come to Oxford and he'd settled, and he married a local girl. And he became a very, very high profile and very well respected man within the factory, within the union. And he was if you go just beyond Tesco's and you go towards the railway bridge and you go towards the Garsington Road, on the right hand side there's a place called Bobby Fryer Close. And Bobby Fryer is one of the best symbols of somebody who's come into the city and has settled their home here and brought a level of politicisation, a level of militancy, a level of sense of justice to make this city a much better place.
Norris, thank you so much for that. There's a lot to think about, and I hope people are beginning to think about their own stories and people they know as well. But I'm going to pass on to Jabu now for the final of the panel. But please,
Jabu. Thank you, Liz. I don't have slides, but I will talk about my experiences. Okay, I will talk about my experiences of coming to Oxford and what has led me to end up being a part of Oxford and being a councillor in Oxford, and all the things that I've participated in. So thank you, Maurice and Danny, for setting up the scene. But I don't know if I can follow that, but I'll try. Mm-hmm. Basically, I arrived in 1984 in Oxford. My mother had already come to Oxford to join Ruskin College at the request of the TUC. She was one of the trade unionists in South Africa, the first general secretary of a trade union called MAU. So she came here to study at a workers' college. Then it was it was the Headington site as well as the Walton Street site, which was later sold. We came at the height of the miners' strike. Mm-hmm. We came at the height of the what you call Live Aid, where people were really concerned about what was happening in Ethiopia. We also I'd say came at the height of when the anti-apartheid in Britain was at its height. The interest, why I bring up that history is very important in terms of the way we navigated through Oxford through that scene, because later on we met a lot of people who came to Oxford for different purposes. When I was asked to come here, I looked at the definitions of, say, asylum seeker, migrant, refugee, to kind of look at where we stood in terms of our migration. So because my mother came as a student, she came on a student visa. She didn't have the same issues as most people from different countries come here to, who come here to settle in Oxford. But it was interesting because obviously as years go by, as we went to school, we integrated with everyone else. So we got to experience everyone's story in terms of why they've come and why they are here in Oxford. So naturally for us, because we're young children at the time, the onus is on mum was to find us schools so that we can get on with our schooling whilst she was being educated at Ruskin College. So the first school that I came across was Milam Ford School, which is based in Mustin. It's no longer there, it was a girls' school. It's now part of Oxford Brookes University. It houses the nursing faculty there, public health faculty. So it was interesting because then we got to know our lives through the schooling system, and that's how we got to know how how to struggle within that, especially having come from South Africa under apartheid and trying to reintegrate into the UK and going into a schooling system that was completely different. I mean, one of the things that I always remember about being at school here was the difference in, the classroom itself, the setup, whereby in South Africa, when we were at school, when the teacher came in, we had to stand up. When you wanted to ask the teacher a question, put your hand up until the teacher said yes, and then you stood up and you spoke. This was total chaos.
Yeah.
Absolute chaos. I mean, the teacher would spend a good 15 minutes saying to the children, "Will you keep quiet?" And they would just carry on speaking. And obviously my mom wasn't aware of the system here, how it worked. We didn't even realize that there was a streaming system in terms of the children, where they put them. There were children that were categorized as to, the ones that were going to sit, it was the O-levels then that were going to sit. They were put in a different stream. And then it went down, and mostly the lower stream was mostly us and the Asian children put in those streams, where we were basically relegated into these will amount to no good, regardless of whether they tested our abilities. So my mother didn't understand the schooling system because she was focusing on her own studies at Ruskin. And it was really, really interesting in terms of the integration. We experienced a lot of comments that were really, unfounded. People thought that we'd arrive naked from Africa. It was really tough. But I remember, because my mother had been obviously a fighter, a trade unionist, she would just kind of say, if they do that to you, you need to fight back. She would fight back, but she didn't realize that if we fought back, it got us into trouble, And so we had to deal with that lifestyle, but also the segregation in terms of who people hung around with. There wasn't much integration in terms of the school. The Asian kids hung around by themselves, and the white kids hung around by themselves, and we obviously were a minority. I mixed with a lot of friends and people were fascinated, but I was considered a very tough girl because I didn't take any prisoners. I was not going to be treated in any way because of what was going on there. But anyway, going back to the schooling system, I had mastered the language in terms of the Afrikaans, which is Dutch language, sort of 16th century Dutch. And I remember my mother, I wanted to do take German in school, because my mother, you know, because when you compare German in terms of the language and the spoken, if you count in Afrikaans, you say E-N-V-A-D-R-I-F-I-L-F-E-F-S-E-S, and then German is Amtswaardrijk. It's a very kind of close, but I remember the teachers stopping us from, you know, getting to this subject. So there was a culture of basically relegating migrant children into low stream. So as time went on, we did end up leaving school with nothing. We ended up with no qualifications, nothing, and ended up obviously starting to get into jobs. One of my first jobs, I remember, I used to clean hotels. I used to, work in the shops. Later, my longest jobs was working in Royal Mail. So the working in Royal Mail was the longest, because I worked for more than 6 or 7 years. But then I started to meet a lot of people from different countries who had come to work at Royal Mail. Kenyans, Nigerians, Asians, all sorts of different people. It was really, really interesting. But the biggest cultural shock for me was obviously challenging the exploitative ways that the Royal Mail, how they were treating workers. So when the union was organizing, I naturally gravitated towards that, because I grew up with the culture in South Africa, with my mother having unionized and having led the 1973 strikes. It was easy for me to get involved with the unions. And I would join in and join in the picket lines. And even in 1984, when we came, my mother took us around to Wales, went to join the picket lines. It was the same as the anti-apartheid. We joined, we went to London. So my life in terms of the political aspect of how to challenge was already infused within me, but obviously it took a long time to really kind of get back into the situation where I feel I could stand for position and challenge a lot of things. But in terms of the migrant and life and integration, people had a lot of challenges in terms of feeling that they are part of Oxford and integrating. And we were kind of fortunate, because my mother was given a house by Ruskin here in Walton Street, and we had a good home. But whenever we visited our friends and kind of went into their homes, we used to find extreme overcrowding. Mm-hmm. I remember a friend of mine in Mustin, they were Pakistanis, Balvinder, and their house, there were like 25 people living there. And this was apparently common across Oxford, where migrants would live in these homes and trying to share the rents, obviously, because Oxford was an expensive place. But even then, people really began to, you know, they were doing a lot in terms of settling to Oxford. They were, you know, setting up little businesses within their homes. They had the schemes like they called the PADO, where people would share their salaries. They would, at the end of the month, put money together so that they can pay for deposits, to get homes. So they challenged themselves in so many ways. They organized around churches. Churches were erecting everywhere. I understand that obviously the mosques were already, kind of there, like from a long time ago. I'm not really sure the history of when, but the other day I went into Bath Road in St. Clements. I didn't know that was like the first mosque in Oxford. So there was that sort of organization. But in terms of, say, the work issues, as I have grown and then understood around the living wage campaign, there seemed to have been that statement in terms of where people end up in terms of the salary structure. Migrants have always been the most low paid in Oxford, and this has carried on for a long time, but there seems to be obviously different influxes. So I will talk about the South African scene in terms of that era. Because a lot of South Africans did come here as an anti-apartheid, what you call, not exploration, but they come because of that that issue. A lot of South Africans did, you know, of that time where people were resisting apartheid were mostly students. But then, say, around the late 90s here, a lot of them came on, say, holiday working visas, and some of them were recruited into Oxford as nurses, and some, obviously, bus driving and all those things. So the particular ones that I came across and got to really spend time with were those that were on holiday working visas, young people. The holiday working visas were 2 years. They stayed here. But the saddest part of it, once those visas were up, they didn't know what to do with themselves. And sadly, that's how I came across the detentions and people being, you know, hauled into Kempsfield. I visited Kempsfield a lot to see people that had their visas had run out, and they had no way of renewing the visas unless some had got married to get themselves, you know, to settle themselves into families. And so many young people went through that system. It was quite sad to visit someone that was working about 3 weeks ago, and next thing they're a prisoner. Yeah. Because to walk into Kempsfield was a prison system. And, you know, just like for them saying, can you bring us cigarettes? Can you bring us this? Can you bring us this? And I remember asking myself, how can people that were working and contributing to the healthcare, to the, you know, to the running of the UK, and then all of a sudden, 3 weeks later, because they've run out of their visa, they are now in this situation. So those issues were really touching to me, and I would have a lot of conversation. But more than anything, that having spoken to different migrants, Indians, Asians, Chinese, it's the fact that people feel that they are not part of the political process. So this is where I began to challenge myself in terms of that, to say, if people are paying taxes to Oxford and are contributing to the local economy, why is it that we're not entering the political process? And part of me now living in Barton, in an area that is, it's got a low life expectancy in council homes, which are, a lot of them are in disrepair. Whatever the council tells, they are not in good shape, and that was part of my inspiration becoming a councillor in Barton. And it was really interesting just speaking to people about challenging ourselves to say, let's enter the political process, let's do this, where people were actually feeling, you know, even till now, they still say to me, you are very brave. Because they are very scared. But it's not only migrants, even the local people. They don't feel that they can challenge themselves into entering those spaces. Mind you, having entered that space and having been a city councillor and having been part of a, you know, gone and sat in the chamber and you know, plucked up courage to speak out, it is very intimidating. It is very much like you are entering the court system. So that was really my journey around, you know, becoming active in Oxford, but also recognizing even when I had my own children that this is how the schooling system was treating a lot of our people in terms of migrants and how they communicated with people that had issues. One of the issues that I've always had is that I have a son who should have been really diagnosed with autism, but he's never been diagnosed. And there's been a lot of communities that have, lots of families that have come across who've said, we've also had the same problems. So the preschool to prison route was what inspired me to now challenge even the criminal justice system, because I saw that there is a pattern of who is ending up being excluded at school, not being given opportunities to actually rise and become, you know, be challenged into going to the universities. And that it's particular, this particular class of people. So I have set up a Mothers for Justice Ubuntu, whereby I have challenged the system here, and I do accompany families to courts when their young children are struggling, or they've been caught up in the criminal justice for one reason or the other. But it's been a lot of things in terms of trying to balance being a counselor, being a mom, and trying to do a lot of things that will bring people to come forward, because my aim was to really bring, to form a movement around these issues. It is really difficult because not everyone feels empowered to actually join, even with the Living Wage campaign itself. We did make strides in terms of involving the student community, in terms of involving the churches, just involving workers. But in terms of what we could do with the, with encouraging people to actually participate and challenge the Living Wage, challenge the schooling system, challenge all the housing issues, it's hard. But I mean, right now, I'm now standing as an independent candidate challenging Annalise Dodds. Mm-hmm. I was in the Labour Party for a while, and I really gravitated towards Labour because I was raised in the tradition. Mm-hmm. But I felt really like a refugee again. To actually be, treated like that in the Labour Party, whereas I felt a great injustice. But the issues that also kind of really pushed me to really say, okay, I am resigning, are also really painful in terms of how I feel the people of the Global South are treated in this community in Oxford. So. I mean, really, my story is not a story that I think is particularly about me. It's about a lot of people that are trying to navigate this system and trying to find a space whereby they feel that they can be part of Oxford. I do feel I have contributed a lot in terms of showing people the way that, yes, we can be part of Oxford, we can challenge. I became the first Black woman to ever become the Labour chair in Oxford, and I'm very proud of the fact that I've made really good friends in the Labour movement, and also one of the things that I'm concerned about is the next generation, really, because. There's a culture of despondency. They are so removed. And at least for me, when I was growing up, I recognized politics. I was taken to picket lines. I was challenged to question what was happening. But I have my young people, like my daughter, who are so disillusioned. They actually have said it to me, what I'm doing, they think it's a joke. It's really, really worrying. So from there, I would like to end this. And if you have any questions for me, I'm quite happy to answer them. Thank you.
Jenny, thank you. Thank you so much for sharing. Thank you. And of course, wish Jabu all the luck she can have in this campaign for these next few weeks. And it's really interesting, isn't it, just thinking about those three presentations that we've just had, and how much people who come from other places have not just contributed to the town, but have made the town what it is, and what terrible experiences they've had, Jabu's experience at school, things to really, really look at that question mark at the end of Welcome to Oxford and City of Sanctuary. I'd like to, rather than kind of trying to wrap up or summarise at this point, I'd like to throw it open to people for their own reflections, from their own lives or people they've known that they would like to contribute to this conversation? Anyone? Yeah, please.
Well, I really empathise with Jabu about the schooling thing.
I think you need to stand up because otherwise people in the back won't be able to hear.
I was just saying I really empathise with Jabu about the schooling thing because when I moved from primary school to high school, there was a big assembly. You know, it was the whole school, and they said, "Hands up if any of your parents were born abroad." I put my hand up. My father came from Egypt,
yeah.
And then the next week, I was taken to do remedial English classes. Right, my mum's English anyway, so I've always spoken English. It's my main language. And I was in the top set in English. I was taken out of French to do remedial English.
What?
So it's. I mean, yeah. And I thought, great, you know, I can get a, it was a real DOS, you know, and I was able to help some of the others in the class, you know, but it
That's
was just
shocking.
Absolutely disgusting.
Really shocking.
That was just pure racism.
Yeah,
you know?
Pure racism.
But did it last for very long?
No, God, my mum was in there like a shocking.
So any other contributions? Anyone else? Yeah? Jean-Marie?
Hi,
come to the front, if you don't mind. Are you okay there?
Sorry, I'm just not quite comfortable talking to be proud of people. My name is Jean-Marie Assambe. I'm originally from Ivory Coast, which is a French-speaking country in West Africa. My settlement in Oxford, coming by the back of the student movement at the time, with a whole change in the political environment in Ivory Coast. And then I came in here and I claimed asylum and I locked out in the country for 10 months, which wasn't a great experience because, for me, coming to different countries, you expect it to be welcome, you know, noise and people will be able to help you understand where you go to, why you left your family and friends at age of 21 to come into different country. Unfortunately, the experience of being locked up, where the alarm goes off about 4 o'clock in the morning, in the middle of December, you don't know why the alarm goes off, you can't sleep. The food that you were eating is completely different to what you used to. So you go to psychological kind of what you call torture of going through, at the time. And it was quite challenging. I won't be long on that, but what I was going to say is I was helping to settle by the Mackie family who was intervening on my case. And I was bailed out, so I spent practically about 5 years with them to help me to understand how the system in England, how things work, how to settle in an English family. And also how to go by and understand what life is in England. And that did help quite a lot. I must say that I never personally experienced any racism anywhere because being a keen football player, I integrate quite easily into the community of footballers and those things. So I beg quickly a link of people who we all have one thing in common, which is enjoy what we like to do. And then from there, I have quite a few, through all those contacts, I have a few job experience that I work in at B&W plant when the factory started to build those unit. And from there, I joined Amazon, created my own logistic company, trying to do all the distribution and everything for a certain time of the year, and then I moved to Thames Water. I'm actually working for Thames Water subcontracted company, dealing with all the water leakage and all sort of things. But yes, that was a bit of my journey in Oxford. And I must say that I settled pretty well with it, like I said again, with the help of these fantastic family, including Liz. So my experience as a refugee was slightly different to someone who coming in and living by himself and trying to figure out how to go by. That's my story. Thank you.
Jean-Marie, thank you so much for sharing that. And the fact that you had to go through that first bit after your student activism in the Ivory Coast, that you ended up in Campsfield, is a real shock. And that right at the beginning, before you came, we were talking about the fact they're trying to reopen Campsfield, which the Coalition to Keep Campsfield Closed, which put on this meeting tonight, is about. And it's no welcome to anywhere to be woken up at 4 in the morning and given food you don't like and be locked up so you can't come. But as you say, you were lucky enough to be with Ag McKeith here and Bill McKeith in their family, which was quite a kind of open family, and be able to learn in a easy way, be able to be integrated and people listen to your story. And now here you are, a civil engineer and doing work all over the world and you know, fantastic. Aren't we lucky to have you?
Thank you.
Anyone else? Yeah, Mark.
Yeah, I'll just move it.
Yeah, do.
Yeah. Yeah, good evening. I'm Mark Goldring. I work for Asylum Welcome. And I just wanted to offer a reflection on what we've heard from three really interesting presentations, but then pose a question to any of you. My guesstimate is that in the last 3 years, we've probably had 3,000 to 4,000 new asylum seekers and refugees arrive in Oxfordshire. And that's Afghans, Ukrainians, and then with the asylum hotels, many different nationalities. What I've really picked up from Danny's intro was just how small a number that is compared with people who are coming to nurse, to run our buses, to run our schools, to study or to teach, and so on. So it's putting that in perspective of that people arriving with huge different wealth levels and levels of privilege, all coming as migrants. And 3,000 to 4,000 sounds like a lot of people, but compared with the annual turnover of the number of students coming through one university, let alone two, or the JR or whatever, it's a very small number, and we should be able to do much better on that integration. And I'm really stimulated by all three presentations in terms of who came, and the fact that lots of those migrants were migrants from within the UK. But then there were other people who came as individuals or groups. And my question is really, who were the other main groups that maybe that you're aware of between you? And what kind of impact have they made on our society? Because, you know, we've now got a group of up to 2,000 Ukrainians in Oxfordshire. Now, how many are going to stay? How many are going to go home? Who knows at the moment? But what kind of impact are they going to make on our country? We've got many hundreds of Afghans who've been settled as invited guests, as well as those who've come from asylum system. And this afternoon I met two of them at the university, absolutely thriving. But what kind of impact are they going to make on our society? And maybe looking back at some of the earlier groups who came just gives us a few clues.
Thank you. So why don't I ask Morris and Danny and Jabu about that question.
Yeah.
I'll go to it.
Well, try to
turn around.
So yeah, try to go fast. For Oxford, this is almost entirely a city of migrants. So I did that thing at the first of who was born here.
Yeah.
It is very rare to find somebody born here whose parents were both born here. Really rare. I know one person, which if you go out to a little village can go back four generations. But for Oxford in particular, there really is hardly a long legacy of so it's just everything. But what's interesting is how after a couple of generations people do kind of say, oh, I was from here. despite the fact that, of course, the car factory, which is the biggest thing that happens in the city, did depend entirely after the initial employment on migrant labour to come. So this is a city entirely of migrants. Even though some of us like to call ourselves locals, we're not that local very much. Contributions, it's hard to know where to start. Perhaps easiest if you look at London. London simply wouldn't exist, despite the fact that actually it's got less turnover than Oxford. I think that's a difficult sign. I could be trying to go on and on and on. One simple one, just language.
Yeah.
If it wasn't for people coming in, we'd just be, we'd have a single language, because the absolute inability to teach languages in this country is stunning. So actually having a plethora of languages depends almost entirely on people coming in, rather than what we learn in our schools or our university courses. But it's culture, wider understanding, and if you look at who is leading understanding the history of the British Empire, it's people who've come from the rest of the British Empire who are leading the understanding of what the British Empire is about.
I mean, I guess thank you, Danny, and I'll ask Maurice in a second, but I'm just thinking about my own children. Their whole language was changed by the Caribbean culture within East Oxford, which they gravitated to. They liked the music, they liked the dancing, they liked the way, so that my own children speak a kind of language, a kind of English, which is actually Caribbeanized. And it's one of those things about language that the people who change it most quickly are often those who are least privileged, which is one of those ironies of life that happens. I'm not going to go on about that. Maurice, people in Oxford, communities in Oxford who've changed Oxford.
I mean, I'm one of those rare people who talk about Danny, because my parents were born in Oxford and my grandparents were born in Oxford, and so we're just really unadventurous, I think. I'm just bucking the trend. Really, really dull.
Good thing,
I think one of the interesting things about the car factory is that for a very short period of time it burned really, really brightly, and I can't emphasise enough what growing up in Oxford was like, because the car factory dominated everything, and the working class culture that emanated from that was far more muscular in the city. And for a while, that's why I mentioned Cowley Centre. Cowley Centre was because by 1939 more people lived east of Magdalen Bridge than they did west of Magdalen Bridge in the old medieval area. So this huge explosion of population meant that Oxford for that short period of time had this really powerful working class, and they weren't dealing with the university, they were independent. They had their own agency. With the decline of the car factory, you have seen the expansion of, and also what's happened is that car workers used to live in places like Headington, and they used to live in, Headington was a working class community, it isn't really now. And as things have changed, those car workers have got old, they've sold up, and communities that I remember as a child being small, I mean, places like Bicester and Whitney and Didcot were minuscule places, and now they've just exploded, they've mushroomed out because people sell up and they get some good money for their house in Oxford and they move out. And the thing that I notice most, and probably to feel the same way, you don't hear an Oxford accent anymore, really, in the centre of town. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of people in Oxford, I can put it on if I want, we're all in girl, but you don't hear it so much, and you used to, because the way Oxford operates has changed. It is a city always in flux, and the car factory's left, but its proximity to London has helped it enormously. The expansion of the university itself, the expansion of hospitals, often actually a lot of them funded by William Morris from his car empire fortune has changed. I think one of the most telling things is that obviously quite recently Oxford United got promoted into the championship, and they took 35,000 people to Wembley for that playoff final. It's very hard to know there's a match day on in the centre of Oxford because you wouldn't know it.
Yeah.
And equally, when the presentation, I went to the parade in the centre of town, and you do think, where have these people come from? Where are these people normally? Because the centre of Oxford is not one that you would consider to be particularly local. It's both national and international at the same time. Oxford is an odd place because you often have an emotional response to Oxford, and often the local is kind of marginalised. But I think in terms of how communities have contributed massively, and I think you know the Welsh contribution, the contribution from other parts of the country have helped. But Oxford is a place in constant flux, and people come and they go and they leave, and sometimes it's hard to get a grasp on exactly what Oxford is.
I mean, I would say that the Filipino community have made a huge contribution to our health service, and we would not have, and just the same as we were talking about the buses earlier and the Caribbean people who were recruited to work there. And Jabu.
I was going to mention the healthcare in terms of, say, the nurses that were brought from Philippines, South Africa, different countries, but also the mixture of the cultures in terms of Cowley Road. We have a really good sense of different migrations there. We've got to taste different types of foods that I would have never experienced. I mean, I absolutely love the Mediterranean cuisine. So there's been quite a big contribution, but I'm starting to see that slowly different cultures like East Timorese have got shops that are being, are coming up in the city. We've got the Nigerian cuisine. There are so many different things, but also in terms of, say, contributions into our social health system, we have quite a lot of Zimbabwean people becoming social workers. Mm-hmm. There are so many different communities that are encouraging their young to enter different professions, which are really contributing to the expansion of the economy in Oxford. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
No, absolutely. Yes.
I would like just to speak briefly about the East Timorese community in Oxford. I served on the Truth Commission in Timor, and at 2000, just before the restoration of independence, Portugal, who had colonized Timor for more than 500 years, gave the right to anybody who was born before the restoration of independence a Portuguese passport. And many young Timorese, in the aftermath of the Indonesian departure, found there was no hope at home. And they took the passport. They went through Portugal, they didn't stop at all. They went to Northern Ireland to work on the chicken factories until they had enough money to come to Oxford. Mm-hmm. What drew them to Oxford? Well, it was 2002, and it was the car factory. Mm-hmm. And so the community grew to the size of, to the largest Timorese community in Britain, to about 7,000, and it's now about 10,000. Oxford's policy about houses of multiple occupation came into play because of the Timorese. There were 30 in a three-bedroom home. You get up, it's your time to work and my time to sleep. This went along until the crisis, the financial crisis, when many, many people were laid off. But by that time, many of the Timorese had learned English, got driving licenses, done night school, and they started doing other sorts of work when they were laid off. They worked in kitchens, they became drivers, and then all of a sudden, in the crisis, what did the government say? The government said, don't go abroad on your holiday. We want you to spend money in Britain, so have a staycation. The Timorese listened to this, And the thing that I find absolutely unique and remarkable about the Timorese community is the fact that their link to the homeland is unbroken. So they went around Bedfordshire, Oxfordshire, asking people, do you have an old VW camper van? They never paid more than £500 for them. Sometimes people just gave them for free. And they got them down to Portsmouth, they put them in containers, they sent them to Timor with an instruction, fix the brakes, fix the lights, fix the engine. And oh, here's an image of the inside of a little English cottage, make it look like that. Paint it out and get it back to us as quickly as possible. All right,
amazing.
They had been being paid £200 a day as non-English speaking unskilled laborers on the production line. That's 60,000 a year, 40,000 of which was sent to Timor for reconstruction of the country. When the cars came back, how much were they selling them for? 30 to 32,000 pounds a piece. If they shifted to, they made up what they've lost. So it's a really remarkable story, and they are remarkable people, and they have done a lot for Oxford.
Thank you so much for that. To think about those different, all the contributions that have come in, all the things that the tremendous drive and work and imagination that has made people overcome things like the experience that Jabu had at the school, which I won't forget for a long time, the being put in the remedial class, Bill, and then Jane, and then three people.
Yeah, I'm connected with the Coalition to Keep Camp School Closed. And that was 2 points I wanted to make. One was a reflection about the car factory. Going back to 1980, this is the time of the Pressfield works and the North and South works, and the Oxford Committee for Community Relations, with Anne Mobbs running it. And the managers at the Pressfield plant were concerned about pilfering small items that people were taking home from work. And the way they counted it was to issue an instruction to all the porters on the gates, stop all blacks.
Mm-hmm.
Stop all blacks.
Extreme.
Incredible. Well, thanks to changes in society and work by union stewards like Bobby Fryer and whatever, that couldn't happen today. So, what's that, 40 years ago? So there is progress. But the other thing, I wanted to go back to what I feel a very burning need to solidarise with Jabu in her experience in the Labour Party, because the Labour Party is racist. I'm a member of the Labour Party. The Labour Party, like other organisations in the country, I'm not saying it's worse than other organisations, but the Labour Party is racist, and the way that councillors, the relatively low survival rate of black councillors and councillors of colour is a manifestation of that.
Yeah.
The treatment of Jabu is a manifestation of that. The fact that the majority, I think, of councillors who walked out because they couldn't bear being in a Labour Party which has its position in the leadership, not the membership of the Labour Party, the leadership of the Labour Party about Gaza,
yeah.
A majority of them were black. Or colour. I think that's right. This is when you think that this is the party that's going to be the majority or the totality of the political party in power in a few weeks' time, this gives us pause for thought, whether you're inside the Labour Party or not. And this is a very serious matter in connection with, are you welcome in Oxford?
Yeah.
As Jabu said.
Genocide tolerating, aren't
you? Thank you. Thank
you.
We'll just come to the end of the road.
Yeah.
I just really wanted to raise a question about education and educational opportunities. Jabu's talked about her mother coming here and gaining a higher education through Ruskin College, through trade union links, we no longer have Ruskin College as such. That has all finished. The contributor over there talked about the East Timorese, people from East Timor, talked about some people going off to night school. FE system has been eroded over the last a quarter century, really. And also some contributors have talked about their own educational experiences and the racism within the school system. I would say that's not historical. If you look at statistics in terms of outcomes from our school system across, I'm talking about England, given the school systems are different in Scotland and Wales, but the school system across England, in terms of outcomes, inequality and racism are absolutely baked into the system. So really my question is, for those people who've come through the school system, or migrants who come to this country who are older teens, young adults wanting to develop themselves educationally, what educational opportunities still exist?
Yeah, well, it's unfortunately that's true, and that there aren't many. There aren't as many as there were when I used to work in further education in the 70s, when it was more possible. It was not great, but it was certainly more possible. Danny.
Maybe a decade ago, the Department for Education did a study about which areas of Britain lacked a university, where there was lack of access, and one was Oxford.
Yeah.
Because if you're local, mm-hmm. now that it's harder to get into books, there isn't actually a university for you, which is ironic when you think about it. There weren't ever many places at Ruskin. I was just going to say that. Point about the Labour Party, or the interesting one about the university. So I've been here 11 years, and one thing has been a proliferation of quality, diversity, and integration committees and courses. And the courses, the standard kind of supposedly cutting edge course in the last 10 years in university.
Are they all run by white people?
Not all, but unconscious bias training. And last few months I've been thinking, occasionally saying to colleagues, what do you think that unconscious bias training was actually about? Over if a lot of children and families were being killed but didn't happen to be white, and was it an issue? And it is just my personal experience of coming back to Oxford, going through all this training about racism inside a university, and then watching my own university react to something, suggesting that the unconscious bias training had absolutely no effect on the vast majority of my colleagues whatsoever.
Absolutely.
Right, anyway.
Yeah. No, thank you, Danny.
Yeah.
Another contribution.
Good evening. My name is John Lawa. I'm a poet, and I've also authored about three books now. The first two is more traditional. The last one was a poetry book, a poetry collection. Now, my own journey is different. Why is my own journey is different? Is because the kind of reception I get from friends and strangers and others in Oxford sometimes is when they see me, the first thing. people think is where are you from, or even the person they ask you is where are you from. You understand? And if I tell them that I'm from Oxford, and I say, where are you originally from? And I say, wow, that question I don't know how to answer that, because I can't even tell myself this is where I'm originally from. Although I know I'm a Nigerian, but. My mom is naturalized British. My sister was born here. I came here, and I didn't stay a year I just left for Dublin with someone I loved. And I lived in Dublin for over a decade. And while I was in Dublin, there was a lot of things I encountered which was nicer and more lovely than I encountered here in Oxford. However, after staying in Dublin, I had two kids, beautiful girls, and my wife then wanted to come to Oxford to work here as a nurse. She's an accountant there in Dublin, but she wanted to become a nurse. That was her lifelong dream. So we came to Oxford because of that. But secondly, because I wanted to be closer to my mom, who lives in London with my sister. My mom's passed away now. So we now came to Oxford. But when we came to Oxford, the things we experienced was disheartening, because my children, if my children tell them they are Irish, I mean, that's another problem for them at school. They stop saying they are Irish, they would agree that they are Nigerians. Because when they say they're Irish, how can you be Irish? You mean you guys went to Ireland to live, all sorts of things. And because of their accent, it was confusing for some other students, you know, Irish accent and all that. That how can you be black and have this kind of accent and all that. And then what Jabu was saying about, you know, segregating students, that happened to my child, especially the eldest one. The younger one has not autism, the other one, what's it called? There's something less.
Asperger's.
What?
Asperger's?
No.
Or
it's like
ADHD? Or
no, it's like autism, I've forgotten the name. It's like autism, but it's mild, they call it mild, it's milder than autism, but she has it and she reads her words.
Dyslexia.
Numbers or words backwards, so.
Yeah.
But we knew that from Dublin, she had the best help and everything, and even the way she speaks changed drastically. She was able to speak normally, but when she came here, we noticed that, you know, things started happening. She couldn't communicate well like before, and we started asking for social help. But they said there's nothing wrong with her. So I went to Dublin myself, brought her medical stuff and handed it to them over in the school. So they referred us to the, social health nurse or something like that. So there was someone that was assigned to her. Then things started improving a little bit. But it was because, you know, we had to put our foot down.
Yeah.
You know, and because of the experience we had in Dublin and everything, we knew that we have to fight for our girl. But the older one, Lavina, she's brilliant. I mean, she's talented, and the group they put her on was like third group in maths, right? And I think they have, you know, different, just like you said, different groups. Now it's like this the girl that gets high scores and everything, so went to the school to complain to them that they have to do a test for. So they did a test for, found out that she was really, really good, and then they put her at the top of the class in math. So I now realize that if you want something, you have to fight for it.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if you're in Oxford. If you don't fight for it, you won't get it. And if you're someone of color, it's even more probable that you won't even get if you don't talk, speak out. So, we fought for her too, and she did well. She's now doing dentistry in Dundee. She lives with her mom, and the younger sister is doing information technology. Now, quickly, I wanted to speak about Campsfield. I've not been to Campsfield, but I've been to some detention centers outside Dublin,
mm-hmm.
and it's not like a prison system. It's open, though the living conditions are not so good, because sometimes it can be crowded. But for families that maybe have two kids or a kid, it's okay for them. The food is nice. They're allowed to have visitors. I do go here, give food to people, and help motivate them, mentor them, and tell them about our experience and, you know, how you can fight your way through to the top. And when I came here to Oxford, another thing I learned was that we need to tell others that if you don't fight for your right, and if you're someone of color and you don't have an edge over others, you won't get the best job. So even if you're a nurse and you're someone of color, you won't get promotion or you won't get ahead fine up than other people that are indigenous. So I tell people, take other certifications. You understand? If you're doing IT, I used to be in IT before I became a poet and author. So I did certifications, I came here, I did my MSc in Information and Technology. And so I've been mentoring youths and telling them that, you know, parents too, that they have to train their children, not only in school. Even if you don't have the money, if it's just you want your child to learn piano, buy a piano, used one, give to your child. Young children now have to learn than parents, you know. It's easier for them to pick stuff up. And we have YouTube, internet now. They can learn on YouTube and it's a lot of stuff. So try to teach your children other stuff. Make them more competitive in the market. So at least when they grow up, they will have that sense of independence. You understand that they can do things for themselves and not rely on other people. But it's also good to integrate. Throughout I was here until 2020, before I knew that there were other Nigerians here. I used to tell people I knew that have not met Nigerians, except my consultant at Churchill. I've not met other Nigerians. And they took me to Banks Road. There is a big football field in Banks Road. And every Saturday, it still happens now, every Saturday you go there, see loads of Nigerians, Ghanaians, and people of color. But the good thing is, not only people of color, white people are also there eating Nigerian. They'll play football from 10 to 12, yeah. Play football, and after that, it's music and local Nigerian food. Mm-hmm. I was like, what? So there are this many, you know, people here. So that's my experience.
That's fantastic. Thank you very much. I think that the place you're talking about outside, Mark and I were looking at each other, the places outside Dublin and not like Campsfield, which is, Campsfield was an absolute lockup. It's a category whatever prison, really. Whereas those places are, there are places like that in other parts of Europe where there are wonderful facilities to help people who are trying to settle for the first time. But thank you. It's really interesting listening to all the need to fight, the need to challenge and, you know, find your feet and really make your mark and be political. The importance of games, of religion, of music, in helping this kind of sense of movement, which we're all in, we're all part of this big kind of moving, flexible community, set of many, many different intersecting communities that we all live in. And just thinking, there's so much rich material to think about how for Mark and Asylum Welcome, for us in Campsfield, for Daniel, for all of us to think about from tonight, about what is a welcome. And we will be writing something up and sending it to the City of Sanctuary, the University of Sanctuary, from today. Danny Morris and Jabu, do you want to say anything as a family, something, because we are getting towards the end of this evening. Yeah. Any of the three of you?
That's right, there's somebody at the back's got something.
Yes, Emma, probably. Emma is from the Coalition to Keep Campsfield Closed. is going to just talk about the rest of Refugee Week.
If I may, yeah. Amazing event and amazing to hear so many really moving and thought-provoking testimonies that, as you say, I won't forget in a hurry either. But yeah, just a little pitch. Refugee Week started today officially and continues here in Oxford all this week. You can go to oxfordrefugeeweek.info to find out more about other events. A special plea for one of them on Wednesday, given that we're here because we really like hearing people's stories, I think you'll be quite interested, hopefully, in this event at the UPP Cinema on the Cowley Road at 8:15 this Wednesday. And it's an original short film that's been made by a group of Oxford's newest residents living in an asylum hotel in the city. I recommend that one. I'll leave the information outside.
Great. So last thoughts, any of the three of you?
I mean, for me, it's just to say thank you, Liz, for organizing this, and the reflection itself has been really empowering. Thank you.
Thank you, Jabu.
Dan? Yeah, thanks. I found it really interesting listening to people. We can't be complacent. The groups I attend in Oxford, which is the least diverse group of all, is the political party I'm a member of, which is the Labour Party. And that is stunning, you know. So although I've said some things have got better, the Labour Party was a more mixed and inclusive thing when I was growing up than it is now in this city.
Oh, thanks, it's been a really enjoyable evening. Thanks for inviting me along. Also, thanks for covering all the logistics, because we were at common ground. We've ended up at Maggie's Den, so. Thank you very much.
Thank you, everybody, for coming and for all your contributions. And if you want to know more about the coalition to keep Mansfield Coast, please sign the bills.